of your children. Kindest personal regards, Jess Hook.
Have to fly, have to fight, have to crow, have to save Maggie, have to save Jack. Okay, he's back.
They're not talking about the best of them. They're just talking about the rest of them. Not the worst parts, but the best parts. This is the best of the rest.
Hello, and all grown-ups are pirates. Welcome to Best of the Rest, the show where we take a second look at movies that were poorly received upon release and challenge ourselves to only talk about the things we like and what the movie does well. It's winter holiday month, and this week we are talking the 1991 film Hook. My name is Chris Logan, and I am joined, as always, by my lewd, crude, rude bag of pre-chewed dog food co-host, Andrew Williams. You ready for this one, Andrew?
Yes. Yes, I am.
I'm just going to take that insult lying down.
You get to live with it the rest of your life. I don't, whatever. You have to live knowing you told said that to me.
Andrew, I'm excited about this week. I'm excited to talk about this movie, Hook. Very nostalgic movie for just about every millennial. I think especially millennial boys, but every person our age, I think, grew up with this movie. Remembers it fondly. One of Robin Williams' probably biggest roles. But what is your history of the movie? Is it something that you watched a lot growing up? Did you have the VHS? Do you know if you saw it in theaters?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, all of the above. I don't know that I saw it in theaters. I was 4 when this movie came out, so I don't. If I did, I don't remember.
Sure.
Also, 2.5 hours in a theater for a 4-year-old.
I don't think you would have made it to the end. Your parents probably would have been.
I don't think so. But my brother would have been like 2. So, like, I think even more so, probably the movies wasn't anywhere they were shepherding us all out yet. But had the VHS as a kid on all the time. Like, I definitely remember watching it a lot as a kid. There are scenes in this movie that are burned into my brain and will be forever. Like a lot of people, a massive part of my childhood, and had no awareness of the legacy of this film at the time.
Absolutely not. I mean, it was like an instant classic as far as I was concerned as a kid watching the movie. Watched a lot. Everybody knew about it. Tons of memorable scenes. And this was, for all intents and purposes, my Peter Pan movie. Like, when I thought Peter Pan, I thought Hook. And I knew it wasn't the original story, but I'm sure, seen the Disney animated one, but I did not watch it all the time. This is the one that I watched. It's one of those things, though. You grow up a little bit, look at some historic reviews, if you're into that. Certainly what I did, hitting up the MRQE and searching a bunch of movies I used to watch. And the critical reception to this, people weren't into it. And even some of the people that made this movie weren't into it. And it didn't have that stellar reputation that I had expected, just based on my love of it and my friend's love of it and kind of the cultural touchstone it felt like it was. I do remember watching it once more as an adult and not liking it, like hashtag PP, but like I watched it like at a friend's house. We put it on, I watched it together, and I was like, oh, this is all nostalgia. This is corny. This isn't working. This isn't how I remembered it. And I what might have been a bit of a snob at that time watching it as far as movies, but I just kind of chalked it up to being like, oh, well, I liked it as a kid, but it's kind of just a dumb kid's movie. And that was the last time I watched it until this week preparing for this podcast, and my feelings have certainly changed once again. Andrew, have you watched it much as an adult?
Not a lot. I rewatched like scenes of it sometimes, just the ones that are kind of in my head, but it's been a long time since I've sat and watched the movie, kind of just truly sat and like kind of digested it and really absorbed it. Obviously, as you get older, you kind of see people that kind of, you see the reception and you're you know, you're not like, I just very much was like, ah, I guess it's not quite what I remember. And I never really went back. Never really felt the need to go back. So it had been a long time since watching it for the show, since I'd seen this.
Well, we're going to dive into it. The positives, the best parts, everything we like about the movie. And when we do, we will be joined by a very special guest returning to the show. Dear friend of the show, Justin Michael, will be breaking down Hook with us. Super happy to have him on. Justin Michael, I was first learned about because of Batman the Animated Podcast, one of my personal all-time favorite podcasts. Excellent companion piece to Batman the Animated Series. But Justin Michael is a actor and writer with a number of impressive credits. You can check out his work on Infinity Train. His other podcast currently going is Nature Talks to Itself, an improv comedy podcast hosted by Nature for everyone. He plays a rock. The other co-host is a leaf. They talk to other things in nature, like a body of water or the wind or a stick, and they just talk about nature. Sounds wild. It is. I highly recommend it. It's very funny, and we are super honored to have him on our show.
Of course, always glad to have him.
But first, we got to set the stage a little bit with this movie, Hook, released December 11th of 1991. It's made on a budget of $70 million, and at the box office, it brings in $300 million. Pretty big hit. Critically, as we've stated, not well received. It holds a 29% on Rotten Tomatoes. That is based on 65 reviews from the time. As you might expect, the audience score is much higher, a 76% audience score. Nostalgia or otherwise, people love this movie.
Yeah, I was actually curious how that swing from the critics to the audience was going to be, and you can see that by and large, audiences like it. I do know people who still say this is not great. They think that it's too scatterbrained, or it's just, it doesn't hit, and whatever. I guess they're the one out of four that don't appreciate it from the audience, but by and large, I think there is a lot of love for this. Like you said, call it nostalgia, call it whatever you want. I think a lot of people remember watching this as a kid, and as such, it's a formative thing for them.
Let's take a look at the creative team here. The movie is written by Jim V. Hart and Nick Castle. Now, Jim Hart is a screenwriter, amongst other things, but a few movies he's known for, things like Contact and later August Rush, which actually reunites him with Castle and Robin Williams. Nick Castle is a writer, but also a director, and directed some other 90s classics like Dennis the Menace and Major Payne. Turns out this guy was a huge part of my childhood. And Andrew, Nick Castle is also famous for something else. What is that?
Yeah. he's famous for clearly co-writing Escape from New York.
There it is.
That is it. But that was his second collaboration with John Carpenter, the first being that he played Michael Myers in Halloween.
Insane.
Which is just one of the coolest little tidbits here. He had also played a small part in the John Carpenter film Dark Star, was also a camera assistant on that film. Like I said, then goes on to play Michael Myers / The Shape in Halloween, a role he would semi-reprise over the course of several sequels. They apparently used archives, sounds of his breathing for Halloween 2, and then he had cameos at additional breathing noises for Michael Myers The Shape in all three of the Blumhouse Halloween sequels. So odd to look back and see his name attached to Hook. He actually, to clarify here a little bit, he has story credit with Jim V. Hart. They wrote an early version of this film back in the mid 80s when it was still kind of being developed at Disney and various other places. His work on the film was still enough that he got story credit for it. And then Jim V. Hart does get script credit alongside Malia Scotch Marmo, who's our other co-script writer here. She had been in various circles, ended up doing some uncredited screenwriting work on things like Jurassic Park, Polar Express, and Enchanted, amongst many other things. But yeah, so quite the creative team we have assembled here for this movie, nonetheless.
And of course, the movie's directed by Steven Spielberg, the most popular, famous director of all time. We've talked about Steven Spielberg before when we talked about Jurassic World, The Lost Park. And
what?
Just to...
Wait, I want you to repeat the title of that film, Chris.
Jurassic World. Oh my God, it's happening. No!
You didn't just call it Jurassic World. You called it Jurassic World, The Lost Park.
Oh, no. Jurassic Park, The Lost World. God, this Jurassic Park erasure.
No, Chris, it's the Lost World, Jurassic Park.
Hang on. The room is spinning. I need to hold on to the desk. I am blaming the fact that they've rebranded the franchise as Jurassic World for me mixing up that title so bad. We lamented this back on Jurassic Park month, that the entire franchise is now known as Jurassic World instead of Jurassic Park. They will release toys from the original movie and call it Jurassic World Legacy Toys. It's horrible. And that verbiage has clearly seeped into my brain. It's the only explanation for how I screwed that up so bad. I'm leaving all this in. I'm not cutting it out.
Good.
All right. Look, talking about the reception of this movie. I feel like this might be one of the movies that we cover. People see it come up in their podcast feed and like, wow, I didn't expect Best of the Rest to cover this movie. It's great. Everyone loves it. Here's the thing. It is Steven Spielberg's worst rated movie, according to Rotten Tomatoes, which, you know, of course, taking into account historical reviews from the time of release. If you ask the average Spielberg fan what his worst movie is, I think they might pick something else. But there's no denying that at the time of its release, it has a worse reception than anything else the man ever made. At the bottom of the list, I have it pulled up here. Hook, 29%. 1941, the 40%. The Lost World. Jurassic Park, 54%. Twilight Zone, the movie, which is only partly his movie, 59%. And those are his only certified rotten movies. That's it. 3.5 movies, basically. And which Hook is one of them. It's at the bottom, which is pretty wild.
It is. There are people who would think that he's made other movies that should be rotten. There are those that, you know, but the body of work that this man is responsible for, and the consistent general quality of them is pretty god dang impressive.
I mean, it's not replicated by anyone else in the medium, right? This longevity with this high bar of quality, no one has yet to match this.
And we talked about this, I think, when we talked about directors that go across so many genres. The same for Spielberg. Like, it's almost unrivaled. This man will make, you know, Jurassic Park, Hook, Indiana Jones, and then also do stuff like Lincoln and Bridge of Spies and The Post and Amistad and Munich and The Terminal. And like, he just zigs and zags and kind of makes whatever he wants, which, why wouldn't you? It's, you know.
It is impressive. And today we're talking Hook. Let's just jump into it, Andrew. We got a special guest waiting. Let's dive into this movie. Everything we love about Hook. You ready?
Yep.
We are podcasting with positivity.
Peter Banning is a hotshot businessman and father of two. After missing his son's big baseball game, he promises to make more time for his kids, but quickly breaks that promise as he continues to make work calls while on vacation visiting Grandma Wendy. After Peter's kids disappear in the middle of the night, a fairy named Tinkerbell whisks Peter away to Neverland to bring them back. Tinkerbell, Captain Hook, and the Lost Boys are all convinced Peter Banning is actually Peter Pan, and soon Peter begins to believe it himself and learns to fly, fight, and crow. Now he must fight his nemesis Captain Hook and save his children before Neverland makes them all forget who they are. Normally it's where I say, like, oh yeah, it's a classic tale, but this is not the classic Peter Pan tale, although for me personally, this may as well have been Peter Pan growing up. Like, this is the first thing I think of when I think of the Peter Pan story, even though it is a sequel, legacy sequel, continuation. It holds that weird nebulous spot there.
It is a weird one, because, like, the premise of this movie is something I fully expect them to announce, like, now. Like,
yeah, it seems in
dark and
with
gritty,
the
like, yeah, the dark and gritty version of Peter Pan, where he's forgotten who he is and he's a hotshot lawyer and has to remember all of the things before. Like, this is, it's kind of ironic. Like, Flubber, we were talking about how that was a Disney remake before the live action Disney remakes or the remakes of Disney were in vogue. And this is, again, it feels like it's a little bit ahead of the curve by being this kind of weird, kind of late stage sequel to Peter Pan, where he's a lawyer that apparently met a woman that made him, or met a girl that made him want to stop being Peter Pan. Like, it's a really wild story when you actually break it down and think about it.
Yeah, totally. Well, Andrew, I can't wait to dive into it, but we should acknowledge here in the studio with us, as is holiday tradition, we are joined by a very special guest, Mr. Justin Michael, once again on the podcast, dear friend of the show. Welcome back. Thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be a holiday tradition. You guys are my holiday tradition.
Hey, look at that.
Hey.
We've already talked about it kind of in the intro, but Justin, what's your history with this movie? Was it a staple growing up, a lot of fond memories, and is it something you maybe revisited a lot through the years?
Yeah, it was a movie that I saw in theaters. I feel like it was a big deal for kids. I was like just the right age. But I don't think I revisited it until college. So it was years. This was probably like my fourth time watching it. So, you know, a good amount, but it wasn't one that I was like, ooh, I got to see this every year. I do remember specifically just the toys that I had. I had like a little Captain Hook action figure, or Hook, with extending legs.
Of course, signature feature, his extending legs.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Tall Terror Hook or something. And then I think I had one of those, like, you know, kids role play. Like, I think you had a hook hand that you could
put. Oh, of course, right.
It was like a Swiss Army knife, which, one of the best parts of the movie. I don't. I have like a reverence for the feeling of the movie more than the movie itself, if that makes sense.
I feel like that's actually true for a lot of people.
I totally get that. Absolutely. I've kind of 180'd on it. Like, it was magical for me as a kid. I remember revisiting it as an adult, sometime shortly after high school. And I was like, maybe the peak of my snob cinema phase, but I was like, oh, this is all nostalgia. Like, this, there's nothing actually here. And revisiting it now, and I think in part because I have kids now, it's back to being like a magical movie for me. Hmm. And hits me really emotionally in unexpected parts. And like, I'm back on board. So I've kind of run the gamut with it. But regardless, even if it's not perfect throughout, I think there's so much that really holds up. And a lot of this movie just makes you think, like, man, they don't make them like this anymore, which is a feeling that I always get into. So let's do that, fellas. Let's get into it. Let's talk about it. Before we talk about our favorite scenes, we're of course going to talk about the cast of the film, starting with the high point, the best casting and best performance of the movie. Because every episode we recognize one person who goes above and beyond the call of duty, that they actually elevate the quality of the entire film with their performance, and we recognize that person by giving them the Mark Strong Award. So Andrew, kick us off here. Who's getting our Mark Strong Award in Hook?
This is a tough one because I actually think quite a few people are bringing their A game to this and have understood the assignment, as it were. That being said, this was a tough call. Came down to the wire. The votes were being tallied at the last minute.
In your brain?
And I actually wrote, I voted throughout the course of the day myself multiple times just to figure out who it would be. And I'm actually against my trend. I got to go with Robin Williams as Peter Banning slash eventually Peter Pan. He has got a very interesting spot to sit where he basically has to spend the first 45 minutes of this movie not acting like Robin Williams. He totally. Basically is like not he's not doing any of the things you expect him to. There's little hints, like he's still got like the charisma and the swagger and everything, but like generally speaking, he's this straight-faced lawyer who is unreliable to his kids, unreliable to his family, seems annoyed at all these things that he has to do, endlessly taking work calls, just this real, like, you know, I'm like, okay, I get why his kids don't like him, but it's, and then it slowly, obviously we get to Neverland and it kind of continues and you kind of see it, and it's eventually as he gets in the Neverland, you see Robin Williams kind of slowly emerge, which is the point, because like, you know, Robin Williams, if there was somebody that was going to play an adult Peter Pan, I think Robin Williams actually is like a voice or a person you think of because he has that energy that you would need to bring to that, that kind of childlike energy while still being able to kind of give it some dramatic oomph. And so to be able to run that whole gamut, this entire movie of like no Pan to some Pan to full Peter Pan, but then having to kind of dial it back and still remember who he is and that, you know, yeah, you're Peter Pan and you're back right now, but you're not going to stay here and there's other things you have to do. It's a very tough line to sit on, and I think he does a fantastic job at every single stage. There's not a moment where I feel like he's not completely in control of what he's doing. And when you finally get to that payoff where he's Peter Pan again, like you're like dying for it. You're like killing me. You're like, come on, man. Like you've been waiting for it the whole movie. When he finally
have some fun, please.
Like for the love of God.
But well, it's what you want from Robin Williams and the character. It is like such right. a good like meld of reality and fiction.
It's again, it's kind of playing in like a very common mindset of like, we're going to repress the fun nature of, we're going to make a Peter Pan movie where he's not Peter Pan for, you know, 2/3 of it. And then finally he's going to kind of bust loose. And, but I think Robin Williams handles that all masterfully. I think he brings the exact right energy to every single phase of the character. And even through to like kind of the ending where he finally kind of brings it all back and he's able to kind of take his past and his present and merge them together into being hopefully a much more involved parent. But
I love it. At the end, his name is now Peter, we talked about Peter Panning to mix them together.
Peter. Yeah, that exactly. Of course.
Is that, was that but, Panning, Banning? Maybe that was too subtle of a joke. We'll the people listening too, are dying laughing, guys. I promise.
Of course.
They're, in your they're votes, laughing. Was the joke too subtle or just subtle enough?
they were, the people are laughing just like the folks for that mayor's speech during the 8 crazy nights last week. But, I think he does a great job at all aspects of it. And we talked about it on Flubber, but just kind of that weird kind of sadness you feel watching Robin Williams sometimes. And it definitely came through here. And just the nature of the character and kind of like how he ran from his past and he's forgotten it and this thing, like all of it just, I don't know, it hits different for me now that he's not here. And it's a little bit more tragic. But there's still this magic he brings to it that's undeniable and is definitely one of the very foundational pieces kind of holding this together.
Totally. I think I'm almost more impressed with his no Pan, as you called it, no Pan yeah. than some Pan than full Pan. The restraint he's showing as Peter Banning, being this work-obsessed dad, and he's got like his little go-to jokes, like he forgets people's names and then says, oh, that's what I said, when they finally correct him. But that's a facade, and really he's kind of an unhappy person. And like when he snaps at his kids, he says, want everybody just be quiet when he's on the phone, and his son looks scared of him. Like, that I was really impressed by Robin Williams giving that performance in 1991 in the midst of him being known as this cartoon character. You know, later in his career, we would see a lot more darker stuff and him playing against type and leaning into his dark side. But I think he's kind of tapping into it here as Peter Banning. And I was really impressed that he was able to, like you said, like not have that charisma show through. And then as he, it's fun, like as he learns to be more childlike, but whenever like he's full pan to the point where he like he forgets he's Peter Banning and he thinks he's like a 12-year-old boy again and he's talking like a 12-year-old boy, I'm almost like, okay. I mean, yeah, we know Robin Williams is good at this, but like I was way more impressed like with the other stuff. It's all good, mind you, but I was just surprised this time through, because in your head, in your memory, you're always thinking about him in the Peter Pan, flying around, sword fighting. But I just, I really liked his Peter Banning performance a lot here.
I mean, if you want to see more of that, Chris, I recommend a film called 1 Hour Photo.
that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. That, like Insomnia, Final Cut.
Exactly,
like he did a lot
exactly
of that stuff later.
Yeah, it feels like almost strange to watch a Robin Williams movie where he's not clearly improvising. Like he feels like he cannot be controlled on a set. And that's kind of what you loved about watching him, whether you knew it or not, you know, when he was like at the height of his career. So I was super impressed, honestly, by him and by like Spielberg. I was like, whatever you did, you really reeled the man in for when he needed to be reeled in.
Exactly.
I was totally, there's not that improv energy you normally have. The one time I feel like it might have been coming through is whenever he's trading insults with Rufio. At one point, he calls him a nearsighted gynecologist. I'm like, was that in the script? Because that feels like Robin Williams, like dipping into his stand up set now.
Yeah, that one felt Robin Williams. I guess you could say he was kind of on the path to Pan at that point.
Yeah, like,
I was just like,
Pan is, he's like, he's like three quarters Pan at that point. Yeah. Like it's happening.
Yeah. I'm so glad we watched Flubber last month because, you know, we talked about, we had that realization. That was our first time watching a Robin Williams movie since he passed away, which it feels like that can't be the case, right? We watched his movies all the time, but not really. And that was a bit emotional experience. And I'm glad we got, you know, we cried on that episode talking about it. So I'm kind of glad I got over that speed bump before watching his performance here. But Justin, have you watched a lot of Robin Williams since he died? Like, what's kind of your relationship with his work?
Man, I guess, you know, I grew up on his stuff, but I don't know if I've watched a ton since he died. I mean, I think The Genie in Aladdin is probably like the big one in my brain. And
everyone's
I don't know, there's this little movie called Aladdin by this
little indie hit shop. On the radar bit,
just a small company, Walt Disney Studios.
Waltz, not don't know any Waltz. That's a new one.
Yeah, sorry, Walter Elias Disney, you might know him.
Okay.
I'm a very formal person. Yes.
Yeah, the businessman. What are the big Robin Williams movies, like tent poles in your brain, like when you think of like the top three, what would you say they are?
Aladdin, I think Hook can be one of them.
Yeah.
See, growing up, like I remember Jack, I remember Flubber, but those, same. I don't know if those had a lasting impact like in culture. I just remember
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Death to Smoochie's.
Oh, there we go.
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Is. That's one we're looking
for. I would say Jumanji, probably another one.
For the Utes.
For the older folks, The World According to Garp, probably. Which was the same time as Mork and Mindy. Dead Poets Society, not really a comedy in that sense, but he's still very much
Good Will
Robin
Hunting.
Like his Good Will Hunting. Yeah. Good Morning Vietnam, Fisher King. You guys were bad at this.
It's almost come, like you looked up right? a list.
No, I know the. I've watched.
That was off the top of your head.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm impressed.
Those The Birdcage. That was a big one. I think that was probably my most watched Robin Williams. Like this, I think it was Birdcage, Aladdin, Mrs. Doubtfire for me were like the big ones. And I think you're right. It's weird. I would have thought I'd watched a bunch of Robin Williams all the time, but I have not. Maybe I haven't seen a movie with him since he died, which is strange. Because he was such like a big informative part of like my childhood. And I just think of him as like one of the big like comedy movie stars. Even movies that I like didn't like Toys. I was like desperate to like the movie Toys when it came out. I was like, this isn't what I thought it was.
Yeah, is on paper it's made for you, but no one remembers that movie. Bicentennial Man. Yeah, see, now I'm thinking of all the movies.
Popeye, the Robert Altman Popeye.
The man played Popeye and Peter Pan. That's pretty impressive to do both
the
of
two
those
big
roles.
Peas.
What range? What range? What dramatica? What dramatic
hashtag
ability?
Hashtag PP. Yeah, that's great. Well, Robin Williams is now a 2-time Mark Strong Award winner. Elite class. Well-deserved. Justin, I'm going to toss it to you here, though. Who's getting your Mark Strong Award for this movie?
I'm torn. Yeah, there's a lot of good performances in this one, like you were saying. Look, if I'm being honest, like pure performance, it's going to be Hoffman as Hook. Like he is just so living in the villainous sneers and like chewing the scenery, but also feels fully locked into a character.
Yeah.
Like it's not like a, you know, full-on parody of that kind of a character. It's not like a paper-thin version of it. And I kind of love how broad he's going while fully living in it. You can just tell he's having a blast. So I was torn between that. And then when I saw them on screen, I was like, you know what? It's going to be Glenn Close as Gutless the Pirate, who appears for all of 20 seconds. I did not realize Glenn Close was in this movie. I looked it up and it was, I guess she was invited by Robin Williams to set and Spielberg was like, want to be a pirate? So I'm going to say the performance she didn't know she was going to give on set that day. And it also wasn't a parody. I feel like she was put in drag and wasn't like playing that up as comedy, which I appreciate. Mm-hmm. She was just like, yeah, I'm a fucking pirate. Throw me in this box and put some scorpions in it. So, you know, a last minute change to Glenn Close as Gutless the Pirate.
That's great. I love that pick. I did the same thing. I was reading like this movie has a lot of cameos, Carrie Fisher, George Lucas, Glenn Close. I'm like, I didn't see any of these people. So I just Googled Glenn Close Hook and I saw her character. I'm like, oh, I remember that character. Had no idea it was Glenn Close or even a woman. Like you said, like it's just they just made her a pirate. That's a man. Like there's no joke about it being Glenn Close whatsoever. And she does it really well. I love the cartoonish puffy beard they give that character. And definitely there's certain, even though I didn't see this movie a ton throughout my life, I saw it enough as a kid that there's certain scenes that are burned into my brain, and them dropping the scorpions into the box is definitely something that I remember as a kid because how terrifying.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Horrible of a fate that is. So, you know, I'm not surprised Glenn Close is a Mark Strong Award winner. Not the role I would have guessed she would get it for, but I'm glad she's in the hall.
Welcome. Deck the halls. 'Tis the season.
Well done. Well, I am giving my Mark Strong Award to Dustin Hoffman. For the reasons you were saying, like, the man is giving a performance. And I feel compelled to like throw an asterisk up here because there's unflattering stories about Dustin Hoffman. He's possibly not the best guy. And it could come to light that he's guilty of serious crimes. And if that happens, maybe I'll retroactively, there'll just be a long censored beep here as I praise his performance. But for now, he's kind of riding that line for me. And I couldn't deny the performance he's giving here. So speaking strictly of the work that he's doing here, I think it's phenomenal. And I remember watching this movie as a kid and like not knowing it was Dustin Hoffman because I was 4 or 5.
I watch it now and I'm still not convinced
it's
Dustin Hoffman.
That's the thing. Like, I go back and watch it now knowing it's him and like I don't hear him. I don't see him. He is just Hook. Like that is not his, like he's doing that voice and it's not over the top, super cartoony pirate, but it is gruffled. It wasn't until this viewing that I realized those are totally not his teeth. I mean, he's totally like, he's always like biting his bottom lip with his goofy teeth sticking out and really throws himself into it. I mean, this is like, it's like Jack Sparrow level of like pirate work. And I did read that.
Where do you think Depp stole it from?
Well, Keith Richards, obviously. I do think Or I did read that him and Bob Hoskins, their headcanon for their characters was that they were lovers. They were gay pirates. They were two queens on a ship. And that's how they played it. There's never anything like overt. They don't kiss each other or anything. But knowing that, it makes total sense. Like, they're just like an old couple that's just living together on a boat. And their interactions with each other. And like you were saying, Justin, like, he's not just a menacing villain. He's a character, and he can be vulnerable at times, and you see these weird sides of him, and his he's almost riddled with anxiety, and like has like this manic energy, and is suicidal at one point. He's kind of all over the place, but I love the take on the character. I think it's a damn good performance. We mentioned both of us gave Robin Williams the Mark Strong Award for Flubber. We mentioned how most Robin Williams movies, he's going to be getting the Mark Strong Award because he's Robin Williams. And I still think that's true. But I think this is the case where, because he transforms so much into such a specific character, I had to go Dustin Hoffman here.
Yeah.
It's like you said, this man is Captain Hook. Like, in my head, when I think Captain Hook, I think of this. I don't think of the cartoon. I don't think of...
You don't think of bald Hugh Jackman?
I don't. Saw that one. I also don't think of Jude Law, the more recent version by the David Lowery. But yeah, and it still gets me because, like, I look at this performance and, like, even watching it now, I'm like, is it Dustin Hoffman? I was like, is it? Because, like, I'm looking at him. And it doesn't feel like it. It doesn't feel like this is Dustin. Like, he doesn't look like him. He doesn't talk like him.
Even at the end where his wig's taken off, you're like, oh, this is where you should be able to see Dustin Hoffman. And I still don't see it.
And he also seems, I don't know. This is going to be a weird one, but I know Dustin Hoffman is short. And in this movie, because he's surrounded by children and people like Robin Williams, he seems way taller. And I think that genuinely is part of what messes with my head. Because, like, something like Stranger Than Fiction, where he's acting alongside Will Ferrell, who's, like, 6'4", and he makes Dustin Hoffman look tiny. Yet here, I'm just like, his Captain Hook seems, like, massive. And yeah. I'm sure that was a deliberate choice, but, like...
Well, as we learned from the toy, he has extending legs.
Exactly. He does. I'm glad we were able to explain that. But, yeah, I was kind of, like, shocked and was, like, every time I look at it, I'm just like, all right, like, it's in this. But, like you said, he embodies this role. He basically is Captain Hook from top to bottom, and I can't deny anybody picking him for Mark Strong, because this is if a movie is only as good as its villain, then this one's pretty good.
I hope I don't regret that choice later. All right, if Dustin Hoffman,
I think you set it up pretty well.
Okay, I appreciate
you like
it.
His performance, not the man.
Perfect. If he looks larger than he actually is, how about this person who has the opposite problem, Andrew? Julia Roberts as Tinkerbell. She's really little. She's a little fairy in this movie. This is one of those, like, retroactively, the movie becomes more stacked as everyone's star power rises, because it's super early in her career. But it looks like they got a huge star to play Tinkerbell. And I like the performance. I like all the special effects to make her small. I like whenever she's in, like, a dollhouse and stuff. I don't know why all her lines seem to be 80 yard. I assume that's something to do with the way they had to film this to make her look small. But hashtag PP here. We talked earlier about how this seems like a concept that would come along now, like the gritty reboot, the legacy sequel. And there seems to be whenever someone revisits an old property, especially when they're aging people up, I always feel like there's, like, a horny studio note that's like, yeah, but what if this character and this character had sex? Like, Bruce Timm always trying to make Batgirl fuck Batman. Like, why is Tinkerbell in love with Peter Pan? Like, that part doesn't exactly work for me. I'm sorry, hashtag positivity podcast and all. But I like Julia Roberts as Tinkerbell. I like how earnest she plays it. You have to believe to keep her alive. I think she plays it all really well. Love story, I can leave it.
Well, and it's so weird because, like, the movie doesn't really play that up until the end. Like, until that moment, Tinkerbell just seems like she's she's like, I got to help Peter Pan do this. And I got to get him back into the, you know, we got to make him Peter Pan again. And then like in the last, like as part of the last act, just randomly, it's like, boom, Tinkerbell's been in love with Peter Pan the whole time. And it's just like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, you know, like it's like she's literally trying to kiss Peter Pan while he's on a mission trying to save his kids. It's like, read the room. Like you understand what's happening here, right? Like, so I think that's what makes it even stranger for me, is it's not like it's kind of even, it feels like it's a last minute studio note, just like, yeah, but what if Tinkerbell was way into Peter Pan? And it's like, but why? Like, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it definitely just feels shoehorned in. You know, it feels like the state of, you know, if you had a woman in a movie,
yeah,
she's gonna be in love with the dude. But also, like, Peter, I mean, I know it's a positivity podcast, but there's a lot of weird relationship stuff in this movie. I mean, Peter and Wendy, and Peter his wife, and I mean, I think that's just like fundamentally weird about the Peter Pan story.
I
was implying that a little bit earlier, but basically just that notion that like Peter is like, oh, your granddaughter, like basically it genuinely feels like Peter Pan sees Wendy's granddaughter and was like, whoa,
sleeping,
nice. Nice,
13,
and it's like, I gotta stop being Peter Pan, this is awesome. And it's like,
yeah, hashtag PP. I do think, you try to bring around to positivity a little bit, I think obviously the book and original story being as old as it is, some stuff isn't going to age well and seem weird by modern standards. I think in some cases they get around that and they improve that. Like the casting of the Lost Boys, I think, is all very cool. And like in the original tale, like, Indians, Native Americans, are like an archetype, like there's pirates and there's Indians. It's like a type of thing you dress up as. Whereas I think they did a good job casting the Lost Boys as multicultural characters to be more inclusive to the cultures they come from, rather than playing dress up as a fantasy character that's not actually a fantasy character. So I think in some ways they improved, and in some ways some stuff that sticks around from the source material that's a little ick.
Yeah, I was surprised, honestly, that they did better than the source material in that way, because I was like waiting. You know, I feel like every time you kind of like watch a version of Peter Pan, you're like, okay, what's going to be here that feels problematic now? And yeah. I was like, oh, okay, we don't have the kind of horrible native depiction. And I liked that. I guess it was really just women who got the short shrift. You know, you got mermaids, horny mermaids, just
oh boy, we're gonna talk about that.
Oh boy,
talk about something burned into my brain. I remember,
well, one thing I will say about one of the mermaids just briefly is that I was just looking up the cast. One of them is now an intimacy coordinator on set, so
hey,
that's an interesting interesting journey, I will say.
I'm curious if it's like,
Because of this movie.
Well,
right. I mean, experientially, maybe.
The positive take would be like someone was on set for her during Hook that inspired her to move that direction. The other way is maybe they needed someone to be that person for her.
It was Glenn Close.
I mean, I can see it. going back to the cast here, Bob Hoskins plays Smee. I mean, just an absolutely stacked cast. Yeah, great. Yeah. I don't know. The Mark Strong is the Mark Strong. If there was a secondary one, I would toss it to this guy, because, again, playing a character, like, I see Bob. He looks like Bob Hoskins. Can't get around that. But he's definitely transforming into Smee, and his voice and his cadence and everything is definitely playing up a character. I mean, this is so close to Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and these two performances, like, couldn't be any different. I love his relationship to Hook. I love how he's his right hand man and his caretaker in that oddly intimate way. And it's his performance that was definitely burned into my brain. I've always loved Smee. Love me some Smee.
The scene where he's like, I forget what he tells him exactly, but Smee like runs into like Captain Hook's room and is like jumping around, and he has that moment where he's like, Smee is me. Like, that's in my head forever, where he's just talking about where Shmi, and he's like, Shmi's me. But Bob Hoskins, I mean, alum of the show, the greatest of all time, also playing Mario. But he's fantastic here. Like I said, it's ironic this isn't a Disney movie, because one of the jokes in a lot of Disney movies is the bad guy always has a henchman that is almost as memorable as the villain itself, and he's doing that here, where he's so memorable as Shmi that he stands basically right next to Dustin Hoffman, who's, you know, making Captain Hook into the greatest role of his career. But he's fantastic every minute he's on screen. I love that they apparently all learn how to play baseball, and Shmi yeah. just like apparently just like learns how to throw even different kinds of pitches so that he can do this and stuff. It's stuff like that where I'm just like, this movie is on a completely different level.
Yeah. He's great. I didn't even realize it was Hoskins when I started rewatching. I was like, this guy looks familiar. He's great. And then I was like, oh, yeah, of course.
it's the short round guy I've seen in a million
movies. Yeah, he's the guy I love from every other movie he's in.
He's Mario.
Yes. Friend of Roger. I mean, I guess he is kind of sidekick to two cartoons, if you kind of think of that. I mean, he gets to have more fun than he does maybe in Roger Rabbit, where he's more straight manning.
Maggie Smith plays Wendy Darling. This is, as we learn, Peter Banning's, not adoptive mother. She runs the orphanage that takes him in. Is that the right? That's what she's being honored for in the beginning. But yeah, they're all calling her Grandma Wendy. So I thought this is, but it's his wife's grandma. Again, it's kind of weird. But she shows up on screen. I'm watching this movie with my family, and friend of the show, my wife, she points out that she's in Harry Potter, which I've seen Harry Potter. I'm like, oh, is it the cat teacher? She's like, yeah, he turns into a cat. And then this is 10 years before the first Harry Potter.
And she looks so much older.
And we're like, she looks so old. Yeah. They aged her up to like 94.
She's like 56 when they make this movie. Like, genuinely.
This is some of the best old age makeup I've ever seen. It probably helps that she was in her 50s, so starting to show some age, but like, you hold her up here versus like Harry Potter movies, and like, they aged her up accurately to what she's gonna age up to.
She looks so frail in this movie. Like, it's like, I genuinely would have thought she was like 80. And like, I was looking and I was like, wait, she's in like all the Harry Potter movies after this. And then I was looking and she was born in 34. So she was 56 when they were filming this. And I was like, yeah, that's perfectly normal, like perfectly healthy. She looks like 40 years older than that.
I feel like the normal thing to do would have been cast an old person, because most of her scene, she's very old. And there's one short flashback where you see her young. But they went the other way. They did the work of making her an old age makeup for most of the time, and then having her be her actual age for the one short flashback scene. But she does a great job. I mean, she's so, she just feels motherly and nurturing, and you can see in her eyes that she still believes in the magic. And like,
yep.
If you give someone that direction, like, it's, how do you process that? How do you put that into your performance? I don't know. That's why I'm not an actor, but she was able to do that. And just seeing in her eyes that she like remembers everything and believes in the magic and knows who Peter is, but knows he has to discover it for himself. She does a lot with a little. It's very impressive. Maggie Smith kills it.
Yeah.
Agree completely. Yeah. There's she's Maggie Smith. She's fantastic. There's this, the performance is so interesting because there's almost this sadness that she feels around Peter, because like, she knows she can't just like tell him, hey, you're Peter Pan, like, because she's the Wendy from Peter Pan and Wendy. That's the whole thing here, is like, she is the Wendy from the original stories. Like, that's the thing they say here, is that like, the neighbor who in here is implied to be J.M. Barrie, who wrote those books, was their neighbor, heard all of Wendy's stories and wrote them into a book. Like, that's literally a thing that's said by the characters here. And there's this sadness that she feels at kind of what she sees Peter as now, because she knows how he's supposed to be, and she sees how he is now, and she's like, this isn't right, but I also can't really do anything. Like, and I think that's why, like, Peter doesn't realize it, but it's why he doesn't want to go see her. He doesn't want, you know, it's been 10 years since they've seen each other last. And the implication kind of seems to be that, like, I think there's this piece of Peter that's afraid of remembering. And so it's this very complicated relationship, and Maggie Smith does a great job with it. But did you catch who played Wendy in the flashbacks where she's much younger?
Gwyneth Paltrow. Well,
yes, it was.
Looks like exactly the same, just a small version of Gwyneth
Exactly the
Paltrow.
Same. I was like, wait, like Gwyneth Paltrow? And I was like, I guess this was before, this was far before anything. This was way before A View to the Top.
I'd love to see that, yeah, that transformation from Gwyneth Paltrow to Maggie Smith just happen in real time.
And then it's like, transfers Maggie Smith and just stays Maggie Smith for 40 years. Like, she's very consistent.
I mean, yeah. It blew my mind. It really did. I had the same feeling. I was like, wait a minute. Maggie Smith's McGonagall in the Harry Potter movies. What? Oh, my God. This makeup is good.
Yeah. Charlie Korsmo plays Jack Banning. Another alum of the show. We talked about this young guy when we did Dick Tracy, because he's in that movie as well. We praised his performance there because, as we talk about kid actors, sometimes you got to do the little, you know, for a kid actor, they're pretty good. But he knocked it out of the park in that movie, and I think he's fantastic here. He makes a lot of, like, genuinely good actor choices, and not just for a kid. I mentioned earlier there's a scene where Peter Banning, like, blows up on the family, tells them all to shut up. And the way that Charlie says, I'm sorry, and looks terrified of his dad is genuinely heartbreaking. But he plays like the other side well. I love whenever he has his baseball glove on and Wendy asks what it is. He's like, oh, it's a baseball glove. It's good for getting hot stuff out of the oven, hitting your sister with it. And it just sounds like that his delivery on that is just very good. He never feels like stiff or wooden in the way some child actors do. He did retire from acting. He's not currently an actor. I feel like he had the chops to maybe seek it out, but I'm sure he's happy doing whatever he went on to do and had some pretty memorable performances in his short young career.
Yeah, hopefully he's just raking in the residuals in some capacity. Not streaming, that's for sure, but, you know, beforehand.
Yeah, he's great. He does a good job here, especially, like, he does a great job playing off Dustin Hoffman when Hoffman is, like, or when Hook, sorry, is, thank like, basically turning him against his dad by accurately pointing out how his father has failed him. I was like, Hook's just telling him exactly what's happened. I don't know. Like,
I mean, the best villain work, you know, has some truth into it, you know?
This is all truth, though. Jack's kind of conflict leading to his kind of turn, leading to his kind of flip back. Like, I think he does a great job with all of that. And yeah, he gets a lot more to do than Amber Scott as
Maggie Banning.
Maggie. Yeah, she's kind of shuffled off to the side for most of this, and the focus is on Jack and Hook there. But he does a great job. You know, like you said, it seems like he had the chops, but chose not to stick with it. I think he went into law. I think that was what I read on his wiki last time around, is that he's a lawyer now.
Yeah, just nobody's like perfect. His dad, Peter Banning.
Very nice.
We have to make him remember you're an actor.
Think that happy thought.
You mentioned Amber Scott. Yeah, she plays Maggie, and clearly the core of this story is between Peter and his son and their relationship, but he does have two kids, and it's clear that he loves his daughter, but the conflict is between him and his son. So
it's clear he has a favorite child.
Well, it's also clear that Maggie's favorite is her mom, so it's I guess, turned about fair play. I don't know, but
Also Maggie doesn't like fall for what Hook's doing. Like, she doesn't buy into it.
Well, she still believes, she knows the Peter Pan story. She's listened to her grandma's stories, and like, she kind of knows the deal. She knows Neverland makes you forget. She believes in all the stories. So she kind of becomes like a playbook for her whenever they go to Neverland. And she does have some standout scenes though. I like, she gets to sing a song that, you know, Peter gets to hear across Neverland, which is a sweet moment. And she gets to yell at Captain Hook that he really, really, really needs a mommy, which is a cute little scene at the end of this movie. But she's kind of more in the traditional kid role. Like, yeah, she's really cute in her little scenes, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, she's great. Does a job well done with what little she's given.
Agreed.
And then Carolyn Goodall plays Moira Banning, Peter's wife. And look, we've kind of talked about it a bit. The women of this movie just don't get to do as much. It sucks. However, hashtag positivity podcast, she has a very key scene at the end of this film when the kids are returned. And she at first doesn't believe they're in their bed, because why would they just suddenly be in their bed? And then upon realization that her kids are actually back, she just completely breaks down in tears that crumples to the floor crying. She is giving everything in that little scene, and it's really effective and it's really good. And she's got some other key scenes, like talking to Peter, trying to encourage him to spend some more time with his kids, and it's all really well done. But obviously, with most of the movie taking place in Neverland, we just not a lot of screen time there. But she absolutely makes the most of the few key scenes that she is given.
I agree.
Yeah.
You guys left out the best cameo in this movie that I'm going to choose to talk about right now. I got a shout out to a person who looks exactly like they do in real life in their cameo. And it is Phil Collins as Inspector Good. Just straight up, Phil Collins plays the cop that appears at their house after the kids are kidnapped.
Is he the one that's suggesting it might be a prank? Is that Phil Collins?
Yes. Yes. Okay. That's Phil Collins. That's the Phil Collins just randomly in this movie. And this would have been a great time to put like Take Me Home in the credits, like, because, you know, the whole thing is about going back home. But
or he just shows up. He's like, you're telling me your kids disappeared in the air tonight?
You know, you could have gone harder on that, Spielberg. But anyway, I laugh anytime I see Phil Collins.
And look, we have a ton of Lost Boys to go through. I'm not going to go through them one by one. They're great as a group. We'll talk about their scenes. But there is one Lost Boy we have to recognize. Dante Basco as Rufio, a.k.a. the coolest motherfucker when you see this movie as a kid. I love this guy. I idolize this guy. I thought he was rad as hell. Looky, looky, I got a hooky in the face of danger. I love it. I mean, he was totally the epitome of cool. And it's the whole Lost Boys vibe. There was this thing in like the late 80s, early 90s of like a kid-run society, and it was cool as hell. Like the original Ninja Turtles movie with their underground skateboards and Sam Rockwell offering you cigarettes, or this movie here where it's obviously a kid-run society, or just Nickelodeon in general. It was like a channel run by kids for kids, you know? You have like, I would watch all that as a kid and be like, well, I know like it's not like a kid running the camera or directing, but yeah, these kids are probably in the writer's room, right? They're probably pitching these ideas and stuff. It really gave you the feeling that, like, kids were in charge, and that was cool. It was this cultural thing in the 90s, and this is definitely, like, a high point of that, just the whole Lost Boys vibe here. But, yeah, I gotta give it up to Dante there in the middle. Again, super cool that they cast an Asian-American actor to play this pivotal role. And up and down the Lost Boys, like I said earlier, just good representation, because these are supposed to be boys lost from all over the world, and it feels that way. And he's super cool. Goes on to have an awesome voice acting career as well. Avatar, The Last Airbender, plays Zuko there, which is just a great character and awesome show. And totally awesome dude. Anytime he talks about his career, he's always happy to like talk about playing Rufio alongside any other iconic roles. So, you know, sometimes people get known for something when they're young and they come to resent it, but he seems to have always kind of embraced his role here. And I thought he was cool as hell as a kid. I still think he's cool. Rufio, what's up?
Yeah, truly. I mean, I didn't even think about it being such a 90s trope, but you're right. I think Nickelodeon was such a huge influence on this kind of like kids rule, like, you know, inmates running the asylum if the inmates were children, the asylum or adults. Yeah, very like Camp Nowhere vibes too, you know, like, yeah. It feels like there were so many things in that era where it was like kids running around doing whatever the hell they want. But like aesthetically, it also kind of like that, you know, imaginary dinner almost has like, it feels like Nickelodeon colors involved.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Rufio, we love you, man.
The best. I know you mentioned that the Lost Boys are all dressed differently, but I also like the implication here that they're all dressed from different times. Because they're not all going to be from the same time. So,
I read that afterwards and I was like, oh, that is a cool detail. I didn't clock it watching it, except for the one kid that's like a greaser. He's like, his hair slicked back. He's clearly like from the 50s. I'm like, that guy kind of stands out, but it's obvious. It seems obvious now that, yeah, they're all from different parts of the world, different time periods. And that is just a really smart design. Very cool.
It is. Yeah, I was curious if Neverland was like in a pocket so that like everyone that has ever come to Neverland is always in Neverland. So if there were Lost Boys of the future, that was my question. Like, are there people dressed from the future here? But I guess no, you get added to you get added to Neverland in real time. So you have to have been planted there as time is passing outside. But I thought that was a cool ripple. And like you said, it kind of very nicely skates past what could be seen as the problematic aspect of not could be seen. It is like just straight up is there's no denying it. By kind of making them multicultural and switching up the time periods, you add, everybody gets kind of a unique visual look. Everybody gets to kind of do their own thing, and it makes it, I think, far more memorable doing it that way.
Oh yeah.
That covers our main cast. So I think it's time. Boys, Lost Boys, I think it's time that we jump into this movie, specifically best parts of the movie and our personal favorite scenes. Andrew, I'm gonna have you kick us off again here. When is this movie firing on all cylinders, and what do you think is the best scene in Hook?
I am gonna go with the moment Peter actually fully remembers he's Peter Pan. Because I think this is a scene where you watch Robin Williams literally run the gauntlet of all of the different versions of the character in the same moment. And this is also where we find out like what's happened. Like we obviously have figured out at this point that as far as everybody around him is concerned, this dude is Peter Pan. A lot of other people don't necessarily believe, like he doesn't believe it. And a lot of people don't see it. But there's all these small moments where it like happens. And it's like, there's that moment with the one lost boy who like stops and looks past the outside and actually tries to look inward. And he's like, oh, there you are, Peter. And I was like, oh, we're feeling things already. This is terrible.
That scene is so good. The way like he stretches his cheeks, that little boy like, gives such a good performance. Kid. Pockets, but, I think his character's name is.
But so we get to this. So this is all building to this moment. We get the food fight, all of that kind of builds to this where it's like, okay, what is going to happen here? And he's tried to go save his kid, and he sees that his kid is basically just Hook at this point. Like, he's alongside him completely. Hook is calling him my boy, and it breaks him. And at that point, he's like, I have to do this. I have to figure out how to be Peter Pan. And he can't quite do it. And it's Tinkerbell shows up, and she gives him the kind of speech. And this is where, we dive into what's happened, so we find out that this is also weird. Like, it works within the framing of the movie, but like as a baby, he didn't like the plans that his mother had for him, so he ran away. This is a little.
I have some thoughts on that little sequence, but I'll wait until we're done with our favorite scenes to try to clear that up.
Either way, so he kind of like the implication, I guess, is magic kind of sends him away, like because he doesn't want this life that they've set out for him. And that's when Tinkerbell finds him and takes him to Neverland, and he becomes Peter Pan, and you find out why exactly he left and all of that, and then it kind of culminates in him reconciling all the pieces of himself. So he remembers his past as Peter Pan, he remembers that, he remembers his segue into being quote-unquote normal, and then he remembers that the happiest moment in his life is his children. And he has that moment where like he snaps back in and he's flying and he's able to just emerge as Peter Pan. And even as a kid, like the magic of this moment is like undeniable. When the moment he is Peter Pan again, because the whole movie's been, I clocked it. It's an hour and 40 minutes into this movie that it's he so reemerges as Peter Pan.
It's so this long. Movie, you're waiting.
There is only a half hour of movie left after this happens. I say only half an hour. Like, that's not but like, the movie takes 75% of its runtime for him to become Peter Pan again. And obviously stuff is happening and like he's doing like Pan-esque things, but like it is very much something where I was like, man, this is taking a while. And then so when he finally does happen, that's kind of what I mean when you're like, you're chomping at the bit for it. You're kind of like, all right, now finally. But that moment of all the pieces of him coming together, because it's like there's three different parts. There's the child or the baby that goes to Neverland. There's Peter Pan, and then there's Peter Banning. And so you have these different pieces, these different things that are all kind of at odds with each other. And then finally, it all comes together, and it works, and Robin Williams sells it. And when he emerges as Peter Pan, you are excited. You're ready. You're glad that he's back.
And they shaved his arms.
Yes, absolutely.
I guess a super hairy Peter Pan would have been off-putting.
We had a note. It was in Flubber. There was a scene where he's like sitting with his hand. He's like on the ground, and you see his hands in the forefront, and his hands are so hairy. It was just so evident.
I swear, this one in this movie, like when he's Peter Banning, like on the airplane, I feel like I saw his hairy arms. But like they, when he's in Neverland, that before he can, they make it a point to be like, no chest hair, no arm hair. It's too weird.
they took him to the waxer, but I was watching this back. It's one of those scenes that you feel the magic and you fully understand, like, okay, this is why you cast Robin Williams as this, because he can do all of this and it works.
Yeah.
There is, I mean, I agree. He's great. It works. He does all this, but just while we're talking about the scene, because like he flies into the Lost Boys camp. This is what we're talking about, right? When he's finally Peter Pan, he comes back. Rufio hands him the sword because he recognizes he's Pan.
Yeah.
It's very clear that they didn't want to put their star Robin Williams up on wires, because almost every time that he's flying, I don't know who that man is, but it is not Robin Williams. I don't know if y'all clocked.
I think there's one shot where it's clearly him like flying across, but yeah, they hide that face a lot.
I mean, definitely.
Yeah,
watching.
Well, it was Glenn Close. Definitely. They were like, Glenn visited Robin on set, and Spielberg was like, hey, you want to do all Robin Williams stunts? She's like, yeah, put me in that beard. he doesn't have a beard. Well, put me in that chest hair.
Beard.
Shave his chest hair, make me a beard out of it. I'll get in character.
Oh, man.
I'm sorry.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. I didn't say that. But it's definitely something I didn't notice watching this movie on VHS growing up. But now, you know, streaming in 4K.
Every single hair.
It is what it is.
Crisp, clear as day.
Justin, how about you? What do you think is the best scene in the movie? What's your favorite?
It's hard to pick. I found myself this time maybe most in...
I swear to God, if you say when they put Glenn Close in a
when
box...
When they put Glenn Close in a box, no. afraid not. I feel like... I'm torn. I there are two small moments, but I guess like scene-wise, I feel like Hook kind of in his element, anxious with all those mirrors around him. And I think also, I really just like... The kind of heavy, longer Hook scenes on the boat, where
the baseball scene, got it.
Yes. yeah. I feel like he getting to see him kind of like live in the character. I guess trying to convince the son is also like probably a top scene. I think like swaying him, there's just something so effective about it, because I think we were kind of joking about it earlier that all he is doing is kind of, you know, calling out the real life flaws of the father of you know, Peter Banning. But it's like, that is like a perfect villain scene. That is like, you're really like, no, don't do this. it's too effective.
Stop. No,
you're bad. So I think like
he's a bad man.
Don't you get it? He's got a hook.
But he has cute little pajamas for his hook.
Yeah,
how can
he does.
Not love this man?
Exactly. I think anytime...
The worst.
Anytime he's in the cute little pajamas with the hook, or the hook pajamas, I think it really is like that, those kinds of scenes, I guess, but I think like the convincing the son, swaying the son scene is really strong for me. And honestly, like the initial scene where the children have been kidnapped, and they find kind of like the hook dragged across the door and kind of like the, you know, little ransom note.
That is so good.
I think there's just something... something about like the off-screen menace and fear, you know, inspired by the character is there's something like wondrous and kind of like otherworldly creepy. And I really love the building of suspense in that scene. So I think it's a tie.
You've got the woman outside the door going, the children were screaming. Like, real, like, that's terrifying. That was a genuinely like scary moment that they built up there. And you're right. That all feeds into this character you're going to meet later.
Yeah. So, you know, vaguely, three-ish scenes are my favorite scene.
Well, no, I mean, that's, yeah, the quieter moments with Hook are definitely part of what makes this movie special. I was trying to explain to my daughter, I was like, hey, I gotta watch the movie for the podcast, you wanna watch it with me, it's called Hook, it's like, it's got Robin Williams, you know who that is? And she's like, no. I'm like, okay, well, you should definitely watch it then. And I was trying to explain what it was about. I was like, well, it's kind of like a twist on Peter Pan. And then she was like, oh, is it from Hook's perspective? I'm like, well, no, you would think so with the name of this movie. I don't really know why they call it Hook. But I guess there are enough scenes with Captain Hook to maybe justify that title, which, again, feels much more like a modern thing they would do. Make, you know, Peter Pan from Hook's perspective has been a popular trend here recently. But the moments with him and Smee, like we've already talked about, the moments where like he is threatening to kill himself because he's losing his mind. He's like, don't stop me, Smee. Don't stop me. Smee, stop me. Get up off your ass and stop me. Like that turn that he makes to get him to finally come up and stop him. Like, there's no reason for that to be in this movie, especially since it's already over 2 hours. And yet I am glad it's there. I'm glad we get this. Because if we only saw Hook whenever he was face-to-face with Peter Pan, or just, you know, turning his kids against him, it would be a good villain, but this makes him, like, a good character. Those quiet moments, those Hook pajamas, his drawer of boots that are all exactly the same, it just informs the character so much that I'm glad that they found a way to leave it in there and just make this long-ass movie.
Gonna say the longer it is. I think this is actually also a really good pick, because like I said, I think part of what makes him so iconic as this character is that there's these different layers, these different pieces. Like you said, if all it was just Hook versus Pan, top to bottom, no question. I think you would definitely have a much different opinion of the performance, but by making it multi-layered, by adding in the whole trying to turn his kids thing. I love that Shmi is the one that comes up with the plan, and then Hook just takes credit for it. Like, Shmi is the one that's like, make his kids love you, and Hook is like, yes, make his kids love me. I can't believe I came up with this. Like, it's like the classic villain doesn't do anything on his own, but takes credit for everything.
Yep.
And all of it's perfect. It all makes it a much more iconic performance than I think it otherwise might have been. So, can't go wrong.
Well, we had three separate Mark Strong Award winners. Now we're having three separate favorite scenes, because I have to go with that Lost Boys dinner scene. That's the point where I'm watching this movie, and again, I loved it as a kid. I watched it again as an adult, kind of didn't connect with it at all. And now I'm watching this scene. You know, Peter is like, what's going on? There's no actual food here. And over the course of the scene, it's the scene where he uses the wooden spoon to flick it at Rufio. Switch camera angles to Rufio getting hit with the colored food. I just made a note, like, this movie is magic. Like, that is a magic trick to, like, visualize what it means for a kid to have an imagination. Like, this, it's real to them because it's their imagination. Like, when you or a kid and you play stories and stuff, like, you don't need to physically have the tangible thing there for it to be real in your mind and for that story. And how do you translate that to film? Well, this is a great way to do it. It turned out Steven Spielberg's pretty good at this kind of thing. I'd love, I love the concept of this weird colored mush. It's just like an imagination incarnate. And right now they're playing that it's their food, and then they have a food fight, and that's the visual of them hitting each other like with this paint is something that I remember as a kid. I'm like, man, I would love to just be on that set and do that and throw paint around with my friends. And it sounds corny as hell, but like it's magical to me. And again, it's weird this movie's not Disney, because this kind of has like a Disney magic feel to me. But I that's kind of a scene where, like, if you're delighted by it, you're in for a ride with this movie. If you're like, that's kind of dumb, if that doesn't work for you, I don't think any of this movie is really going to work for you. So it just felt very pivotal to me. Like I said, this viewing is the time like where I really sunk back in and I realized like, yeah, I'm really into this. This is a ton of fun. And I love their insults back and forth. I get the nearsighted gynecologist. There's a lot of other good stuff here. Another Robin Williams line that felt like it might have been coming from him is when they're telling him to eat in this empty bowl. And he says, "Eat what? There's nothing here. Gandhi ate more than this." I'm not sure that one was in the script either. But it's just such a fun scene that ends with a imaginary food fight. Like, it's just really cool to me. And the Lost Boys in general, I think, is my favorite part of this movie. And that's kind of the highlight of their little clubhouse to me.
I agree. I think I don't know what those whipped cream pies are made of. I assume it's just whipped cream, but they looked delicious. And it's so bright. It's so colorful. Like, that's the other thing, too. Like, you know, a lot of the Neverland stuff, like you're on the pirate ships, it's all those tones. When you're in the Lost Boys woods, it's again, we're all. So to have this food fight where the thing you're fighting with is just these bright, vivid colors, kind of also just simply mirrors what is happening with Peter Pan, where he is, his world, he's opening his mind, Quaid, like he's doing the thing he needs to do in order to get back to where he needs to be. It's opening up his imagination, you know, letting this vivid world in, and they are representing that with literal vivid colors. And I think that is a very cool visual metaphor to go along with that, and it just makes the scene stand out.
Totally. Agreed. Y'all said everything I think.
No notes.
No.
This, you know, we've talked in the intro about this movie's kind of critical reception. Like, it wasn't a hit with critics. And even, like, the creator, like, Steven Spielberg never spoke highly of this movie. Like, from the time it came out, he's kind of wavered from, it was okay, I would do it differently now, to, like, I don't like that movie. And he considers it one of his lesser efforts. And he talks a lot about, you know, I really just relied on the production and art direction to carry the movie. And that is definitely a standout. But it's also, I vividly remember reading Roger Ebert's review of this. And one of his big criticisms was the Pirate Bay. He said it just looks like a Walt Disney theme park. And it kind of does. Like, it kind of looks like a Pirates of the Caribbean ride that you just walk through. And I was kind of wrestling with that in my mind as I watched that. Like, is that a negative, though? And I was thinking, like, maybe it's too far to say, like, Steven Spielberg intentionally made this look false-looking because it's Neverland and he wanted to separate it from the real world. I mean, I definitely think he wants it to have a distinct look from the real world, but did he... I mean, that thing looks like a studio set. It's shot on a studio set, and it absolutely looks like a studio set with, you know, a big painted wall in the background. And I was thinking, like, is it did he want it to look a studio set, or is that maybe me trying to be too generous because I'm enjoying this movie? But then there's the scene of Peter flying later, and you see, like, in the ocean below him, a giant compass, like, in the water as if he's above a globe, which I think lends to this false nature of Neverland. Like, I think it's supposed to feel, I don't know if fake is the right word, but maybe it is the right word. Fake, imaginary, this place in your mind that's not quite real. So while I'm not sure I would go as far as say he wanted to feel like a set, I think there's like a false nature that was intentional with the set of this movie that maybe people read differently, you know, Robert Ebert didn't connect with. But I think it was on purpose. I think it's supposed to feel like a stunt show as he walks through the Pirate Bay the first time. People are jumping through windows and stuff. Like, I think that's actually what they're going for. I think that was the kind of the idea of Neverland.
Yeah, I had the same feeling when I was watching it. I mean, one, I was just thrilled to see a practical set. You know, I 100%. Think we're so mired in you know, whatever, digital effects replacing everything just because it's cheaper. And it's, you know, to some extent can really like sweeten and augment things. But I had the same feeling. I was like, almost this unreality was, I think, yeah, fake feels almost negative, but like, yeah, unreal. Like it felt yeah. like tangibly, it felt like a dream. And I think in some ways, maybe it feels like it helps it. And maybe also what people were bumping against when it came out is that everything was practical at that point. So the fact that it did look like a set compared to, you know, other movies that were doing the same thing and it didn't, you know, made it feel unintentionally bad. But I loved it. I loved that it was on a set. I loved that it had like big backdrops. I loved it had just clear lighting and color and, you know, that really felt false in a good way. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what a dream to see that many actual people, you know, that many extras.
Yeah, I mean, I was taking so many notes about just small little decisions in the set dressing. Like, how about the window lock of the kid's bedroom being Hook's hook that slides over? Like, it's such a cool little idea.
Yeah.
I talked about Hook's pajamas. I mentioned that one more time because it's hilarious that his Hook has pajamas. Hook's double cigar. Did you see that? It's like he has two cigars. In, I don't know what you call that thing, some kind of apparatus, so you can smoke two cigars at once. Wild. It's wild stuff. I love his red carpet that he has to have to walk down the stairs.
Oh my god, that Shmi effect just, was incredible. Like, the fact that people had flawless. To it's create perfect. That, and on a dime, it could, like, you know, kind of flop open. I don't know. The magic of that was so exciting to watch. Yeah, the prop... The set dressers, the set design, production design was like kind of the star of the show for me.
It's
oh, absolutely.
The fact that it's real is what makes you, especially as a kid, want to be in that world. So we can talk about the final fight here. Like, all the kids getting ready, all the Lost Boys getting ready to go to war, putting those helmets on and their handmade guns. There's one like suit of armor that's up in like cobwebs, and the kid just walks through it to get dressed to put the suit of armor on. Like, that, the fact that it's all real and tactile really lends to you wanting to like be there. And as a kid, like, actually be there. As an adult, like, I would love to see those props and hold them and like look at them. Like, it's just, it's cool. But you only get it if you do the thing for real.
Yep.
Yeah. Is it a theme park thing? It almost feels like it. The set feels like a theme park. The props feel like theme park props. Like, you saying, like,
yeah, 100%.
As a kid, you want to be there. It's like kind of this imaginary, physicalized version of reality, but it's like you want to ride. It felt like a, like when I was a kid, I went to like Fievel's Playland. I don't know if anybody lived near a Universal Studios, but they had like an American Tales themed area where you were like the size of a, you know, a mouse, and you would slide down a banana.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I was like, oh yeah, that's what running around that Hook set looked like.
Yeah, totally. Even like the end, like the big final fight, the kids like board the ship by swinging across ropes. Like, it feels like a stunt show at a
yeah.
at a theme park.
Yeah.
There's always an explosion in the background and someone that's clearly being launched from a springboard, you know, flipping through the air. It's great. I love that stuff. I love there's the gun at the end that shoots eggs, and it's got a basket of eggs. And in the basket of eggs is a live chicken, as if the chicken is like actively laying eggs to refill the gun. It's such a silly concept.
Yeah, love it.
I loved, there's the, you know, particularly robust Lost Boy that rolls into a ball and rolls down the stairs. I thought that was the funniest thing as a kid. You watch it now, like, that's clearly a prop rolling down the stairs. That's clearly like a doll they sewn into a ball. But I totally bought it as a kid. I'm like, how does he do that? That's such a cool little talent to roll down like that.
Yeah, that's like one of my core memories of this movie. It's like, yeah, the imaginary dinner, little rolling boy, and Hook's extending legs, which we definitely see as a pivotal part of the film.
man. Rufio dying. That's emotional. It's like I knew it was coming. Like I was prepared. But one thing that hit me harder this time, you know, talk about viewing this as a parent. Am I the only parent on this podcast, Justin?
I'm not a parent.
Just me? Okay. All right. So I'll speak for all dads here. he gets killed, and as he's dying in Peter Pan's arms, he says, "I wish I had a dad like you." And it's like, it's kind of what you're talking about earlier, Andrew, like him being all versions of Peter at once. Like he's Peter Pan, but he's also a father figure, learning how to be a father figure, and he's doing it all finally together as one. And Rufio's recognizing that with his line. And there's this father-son relationship drama throughout this whole movie that Spielberg is definitely obsessed with. There's a line in the beginning that Peter's wife delivers that says, "You need to play with your kids, because with a short amount of time where we are the ones chasing, or they're the ones chasing us. They're the ones that want to spend time with us. And soon we will be chasing them to get some time." And it's like 5 minutes in the movie, I'm already like starting to like tear up and stuff. And they keep coming back to the note over and over again. And that's the kind of thing that like hit me in a way that my other previous experiences watching this did not. But father-son stuff always crushes me, and there is no shortage of it in this movie.
Yeah. I think you don't have to have kids to feel it too. All you need is a father who abandoned you. So,
everybody. Okay, I don't know.
So we did mention in passing the kind of Hook enters the house like aftermath scene, and I did just want to highlight this because I actually do think this scene is really, really cool. Because like you see it as like something is happening, and it's actually really. I think it's funny because they frame it like he's coming through the window. But then the path, he takes a path through the house to the room.
Unless he went out the front door. Could be the other direction.
Or maybe the window was opening in anticipation of him coming up and flying out the window. I don't know. Anyway.
Okay.
But this is just very effective. Like, it's so interesting because, like, if you told some, like, if someone had no idea what this was, like, you had no idea that this was, like, a stealth Peter Pan sequel. I feel like there's a good chance you could get to that point in the movie and not really get it necessarily, like what exactly is happening here. But the moment like there's a thing hooked on the door, like a knife on the door with a letter that says "from James Hook," and then I feel like that's a moment that it would all like you would have the like the usual suspects moment where like all of the pieces click together at once and you would be like, "Oh, this is no way." So like this scene is like very effective in creating a sense of dread, making you remember and feel that this villain is like dangerous and just really, really good. I like it a lot.
Totally.
Yeah. It's like a, "Oh, the legends are true" moment.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Do you think, is the end supposed to be ambiguous? Like we see Bob Hoskins as the guy sweeping up the street. We see Tinkerbell again, but also it could just be a glare over the statue. Do you read that as we're supposed to believe like maybe Neverland is real, maybe it's not, or there's just a little bit of magic still with him? Like what's your take?
I've never read that ending as none of this was real. Like I've always like Tinkerbell appears one last time before leaving. And I think Shmi is the sweeper is just like an Easter egg. Apparently in the original play, which is actually what this is based off of, Wendy's father and Captain Hook were typically played by the same guy. So I think this might be kind of like a callback to things like that, where you just have this guy that kind of exists in both places. And then obviously you have Tuttles like flies off to Neverland at the end of this. Like, it's
okay, well that's
real.
Fair. That's I guess I can't argue with that. It almost has like a Wizard of Oz feel for a minute, where it's like it could have been in his head and he populated it with things from his life. But yeah,
his kids were there too, though. Like, it's not just him.
Hey, listen, I was just asking the question here.
Some questions don't need to be asked.
I like that. He has to remember being Peter Pan, right? He has to remember how to fight, right? Sword fight, take on Captain Hook. He has to remember how to fly. He's got to freaking fly through the air. And remember how to crow. I like how one of the three skills that he has to have to be Peter Pan is to make a chicken noise. I don't know why that one is given such reverence, but I do really like that. That's Hook. It's a lot of fun. I think it still, I don't know, has the magic. I remember it fondly in my head, and it's one that lives up as far as I'm concerned, revisiting those childhood memories. And Justin, thank you so much for joining us for this. Again,
yeah, of course.
It's thank you. Third year in a row now, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
We did,
because we did Batman Returns and Jingle All the Way.
That's right.
And we've completed the trilogy.
With Hook.
Well, we hope to keep the tradition going. We'll definitely love to have you back next year. But seriously, it's such an honor to have you on our show. As I'm sure I've said in previous appearances of yours here, Batman the Animated Podcast, truly one of my all-time favorite podcasts. And having you as a guest here, it's the podcast equivalent for me of like meeting your heroes. And you totally debunk the old saying, because you're just a joy to have on. And you give us so much whenever you join us and join these conversations. And I'm just super thankful that you're willing to do that. And yeah, thank you. Totally thank you. And now tell everybody listening where they can continue to hear some of your work.
Well, I mean, first, thank you. That's like the nicest thing anybody could say.
No, I've got to cut you off. You got to go straight to plugs. You can't show any appreciation for the nice words I said.
All right, yeah. let me like kind of debunk whatever you think I am. Fuck off, all three of us together. No, I think... If you want to listen to more of this voice, Batman the Animated Podcast is still available online. It's not an active podcast at this point, but it's one where I talk to, people who made the 90s cartoon Batman the Animated Series, and you can find that wherever you get your podcasts, or BTAS Podcast on Instagram and I guess X. Yeah, the legacy Twitter account is still there.
I refuse. I say Twitter. I can't.
I have another podcast called Nature Talks to Itself. It's wholly different. It's an improvised comedy. So every episode, it's the first podcast by nature for anybody. So I play a talking rock named Tony Geode. And my co-host is a crunchy leaf named a tiny crunchy leaf, and we have guests on, comedians from all kinds of places. So we have like Rachel Bloom and Nicole Byer and Tim Simons from Veep. It's a lot of fun people. So that's Nature Talks Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Otherwise, I don't know. Watch Infinity Train if you can find it. It's a show that I wrote on that was fully removed by David Zaslav.
I genuinely wanted to ask you like how I can find it now, because they took it off Max, right?
Yeah, I think it might even be removed from iTunes at this point. But look it up. I'm sure there are other ways around that. And at some point in the near...
How would Captain Hook watch it? How about that?
He would pirate it. doing a full not Hook-style pirate voice. I have another show that I worked on coming out sometime soon. There's an animated adaptation of the video game Among Us. It's going to be good whenever it's out. Animation takes a while. But thank you so much for having me. Oh yeah, Hey Justin at Hey Justin is my personal social handle.
You can be on anytime as long as it's December.
Okay, that's the rule.
We are podcasting with positivity.
All right, Andrew, that is three winter holiday movies down. Just One to Go, Reindeer Games, coming up next week, starring Ben Affleck. A movie that is almost used as a punchline more than an actual movie reference. Have you seen Reindeer Games, Andrew?
Probably.
Yeah, I think it's about the attitude. I don't think I've ever seen it, but I do own it. So we'll be checking that out, talking about it next week. But for now,
Hey, get the hell off me.
Excuse me. Was that a Justin's not in the studio?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Let me shift. All right. I'm moving.
Ah, okay, there we go. Yeah, lift me up to the microphone.
All right, here. Let me get you your own mic here. All right.
What is going on here?
Yeah, what is going on here? You know, and I was having a nice sit on what I assume is, just a very, just on some sort of chair, and then some a-hole just sits his ash on my head.
Did you walk in here? How did you get into our studio?
Yeah, I tell you, I don't even know. I think I was batted here by a bear. You know, I really have no arms. I have no legs. I'm a geode, as you can tell. Tony Geode,
I see that.
What the hell's going on here?
Well, I feel like I should be asking you that. I've never heard of a geode that can talk. It's a little strange to me. How are you doing this?
Oh, you've heard of a reindeer that can play a game, but not a geode that can talk. Very interesting.
I mean, I guess you got me there.
Yep, okay, bye.
You seem awfully comfortable speaking into a microphone. Do you do this a lot?
Yeah, I host a podcast with a tiny crunchy leaf. You know, Nature Talks to Itself. Ever heard of it?
With a tiny crunchy leaf. What's their name? It's kind of rude just to call them a tiny crunchy leaf.
A tiny first name, crunchy leaf last name. Okay. Yeah. We talk in the mushrooms. You know, mushrooms are the great communicators of the world and nature. We're just trying to give nature a voice after you humans have completely ruined the planet.
Okay, well,
that's
true.
We did do that.
I mean,
I like this guy.
There, you got us there.
No defense there. Well, look, we've got to finish out this podcast here. Normally, what we do at the end here is we take a question from one of our listeners. We give our best answer. I mean, you're here. You're talking. It doesn't look like you're going anywhere. That there's no bears around to bat you out of here. So, would you like to join us here? Be our guest here?
Yeah, and happily be your prisoner slash impromptu guest.
All right, fantastic. Well, listen, this week we have a question from Gobble Groffle. We asked in our Discord. They say, I believe there's been plenty of discussion on Batman, but in the same vein, why don't you rank your Jokers? All your Jokers, live action to animation to video games, anything in between. And they do provide a very exhaustive list, like Mark Hamill, Barry Keoghan, Heath Ledger, Jared Leto, Jack Nicholson, Joaquin Phoenix, Kevin Michael Richardson. It goes on and on. There's been a lot of people play the Joker, but what are some of your favorites? Tony, have you seen a lot of Batman media?
I know the Batman. He's this guy. He's composed entirely of various species of bats. Kind of walks around, in an overcoat, sort of wanders around trying to fool people into thinking he's some sort of man. But, you know, when you can only get by echolocation and there's 400 of you in an overcoat, it makes it a little obvious that you're not a human. So, yeah, I'm familiar with exactly what you need to talk about.
Yeah, I'd say you're about 15% there, but for sake of conversation, we'll say that's enough.
Yeah, and I do thank Mr. Gobbles, my fellow turkey friend for asking the question. It's nice to have, a fellow piece of nature on the pod.
Hey, we welcome all creatures of any kind into our community. We're very open like that.
That's great. Couldn't disagree more on my count, but thank you. That's very nice of you.
All right. Well, as we all know here, Batman has a nemesis called the Joker. It's been portrayed by plenty of different people. I think maybe it's my age, but Heath Ledger, there's just no topping that performance of the Joker. It's going to be my number one with a bullet.
Mark Hamill, no question.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I gotta say my favorite Joker is probably that Phoenix fellow you were talking about, I love a bird that rises from the ashes. You know, it's pretty impressive to resurrect oneself.
Yeah, yeah, Joaquin Phoenix, I think is what you heard me say.
I'm walking here, come on. Classic New York rock comedy.
Well, how about John DiMaggio? He played the Joker. Are you familiar with his work, John DiMaggio?
Yeah, John DiMaggio. You know, no. John DiMaggio, no. You know, sometimes if I say a name a few times in a row, it can spark a memory, but...
Sure.
You know, in this case, that did not. What else you got? Come on.
Well, Zach Galifianakis, he's a comedic actor. Most people know who Zach Galifianakis is. I'm not sure if his comedy reaches you in the forest or riverbed or wherever you hang out, but Zach Galifianakis?
Yeah, honestly, never heard of the guy. You know, I mean, our kinds of comedians are, you know, I know a cricket who's very funny, kind of like, usually they sort of make music with their arms, but this guy makes kind of a fart, so, you know, sound, it's...
A farting cricket. That sounds right up my alley, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell just by the way you sat on my head.
It was not comfortable for me, I should say. You've got some points. You've got some edges.
Yeah.
Are you a piece of a geo? Did you break off of something?
Yeah, I actually did recently crack in half. I was so surprised I blew apart. So, yeah, I am a little pointy. I am a little sharp. I'm desperate to know what's inside of me.
Well, I hope you bought the part dinner first.
See, hey, I can do, now that's I can the kind do of joke improv that I can comedy get too. Yeah, just really pandering. <We're>, I got farting cricket. You got taking the other half of me on a date.
Well, Andrew, any other shout outs you think we need to give to some Jokers? I mean, Jack Nicholson, we haven't mentioned.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson, like, that's obviously, like, I love Batman 89. Jack Nicholson is always going to be something that I think of a lot when I think of the Joker, that kind of classic, you know, the big wide purple hat, the way he dresses, that image of the Joker is definitely in my head. Obviously, Barry Keoghan, Kogan, I haven't really seen much of him yet. I think it's hard to kind of say anything one way or the other, but and Cesar Romero, I got to give a shout out to the man, so dedicated to the part, he wouldn't shave his mustache.
R.I.P. You know what I mean? Turned into a Caesar salad too soon.
You're very literal with people's names. That's not really how human names work. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I mean, I'm just assuming he's a, you know, head of lettuce that got chopped up into a salad with the name Caesar.
I get that your friend, a tiny crunchy leaf, is. A tiny crunchy leaf, but typically that's not how we name ourselves. Did you know this?
I mean, yeah, here's the thing. You guys are freaks and we're normal. You know, I'm a geode.
I mean, you got us there too. So
yeah, once really again.
I mean, also, Batman is not 89. You know, whatever you were saying about this guy, you know, he's collectively maybe 1024 or something.
Oh, fantastic.
I don't mean to be rude. I'm just a prisoner on your podcast.
No, we love having you and mixing it up a little bit. Normally, it's just me and Andrew by ourselves at the end, so it's nice to have a little bit of company. You know, you like talking to other people, right? You do it all the time.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, people don't like talking to me, but I make sure that they listen to me talk.
Do you talk to humans very often? Do most people take? I feel like, not to toot my own horn here, I've kind of taken it in stride.
Yeah, please don't toot your horn. I'm, you know, right near you. I don't think I've talked to a human. I talked to a haunted doll once, you know, which is the closest you kind of get, but that's kind of it.
That's an accurate description of most humans, I guess. Haunted doll, flesh and meat puppets. It's fair enough. I can see how you'd make that connection there.
Yeah, you said it to me.
I think we've talked about the best of the Jokers. I mean, where they actually rank specifically is in a very person to person, but there's a very long, exhaustive list provided here by Gobble Groffle. But most of these people aren't going to be touching Mark Hamill in the voice acting realm. or Heath Ledger, Jack Nicholson in the live action. But I do, you know, I mentioned John DiMaggio. I know, Tony, you're not familiar, but he's a very accomplished voice actor, and he does voice the Joker in Under the Red Hood, which is one of my personal favorite animated Batman films. And if you're not going to get Mark Hamill, I think he does a great job playing the Joker and putting his own kind of spin on it. That still feels very Jokery to me. So I do want to shout that out.
Well, great. That's great. That's great to hear. You know, having no fundamental understanding of what a Joker is or, you know, what they may do. I feel like I've learned a lot here.
The Joker is a human, unlike Batman, who we established is a swarm of bats. The Joker is a human who has actually fell into some chemicals. He's got white skin, green hair, red lips, kind of a freak of nature.
So in a way, Joker is just a further proof of how humanity has ruined the planet by the nature of there being chemicals that could do such a thing. So I understand if you're not a fan. I understand this is going to be a difficult conversation for you. So if we need to just let this go, we can.
As a society, that's Joker's whole thing.
I mean, honestly, sounds kind of great.
Chris, I hate you.
Hey, buddy, why so serious, my friend? Come on.
Hey, I know that was totally coincidental, but that's kind of a Joker thing. It's pretty good.
All right, maybe I'm a Joker. Maybe I'm the new Joker. Maybe inside of me is some sort of freaky clown.
Tony Geode as the Joker. Tony Joker. I think someone could offer you got an agent, but I think there might be something there in your future.
All right, I'll work on it.
All right, well, look, we're going to wrap up the podcast. Pleasure having you here. I've got some few things to say that end the show, and then do I need to throw you out a window, or how do you move on?
Yeah, honestly, if you don't mind, if you could just give me one good chuck in a direction that looks pretty cool, that'd be great.
All right, sounds good. Look, I'm going to read these closing credits, and then I'll get you out of here. Okay?
Oh, cool. I got to listen to the credits. Great. You can't me out the damn window.
No, that's
and I'm not a prisoner on your show.
Like,
if
I
gotta listen
otherwise.
To the credits every week, you gotta listen to the credits every
that's
week.
Fair. I'm sorry, buddy. I hope you get thrown out the window too soon.
I keep hoping.
We will be back next week. Remember, until then, not every movie is great,
but all movies have greatness.
Thank you to Mark Benavides for singing our theme song. You can follow him on Instagram at NotThatMarkAnthony. And thanks to Mitch for the music. Check him out on Twitter at I'mABiggieBoy. And check our show notes for the SoundCloud link. Check out our store on TeePublic for some Best of the Rest merch. And if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. That is the only way that we grow. Thanks once again to Justin Michael for joining us on this episode. And thanks to our latest friend of the show, Tony Geode, for helping us answer a question about the Joker. And that's all, folks. Thank you. All right, Tony, you're heavier than you look.
Come on. We just met. That's pretty insulting.
You can't just say that to someone in 2023, Chris.
Thought it was a compliment for a Geode to be heavy. I thought they take pride in their heft. I don't know the
proper term, as always, is thick with three C's.
Yeah. Hey, okay. I like this guy. Throw me over to him.
All right. Andrew, can you get that window for me? I don't want to break it.
Yes, I can. Here we go.
I shall. Oh, yeah. Hey.
Oh.
You didn't throw me far enough.
Well, we got to get out of here. I hope the bear comes around. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
Bye.
Oh, that was weird. Yeah. Cross promotion is what podcasting is all about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
It's why we do it, not for the love of the podcasting, but so we can promote other people's podcasts.
Absolutely. I hate this.
Yeah.
I can't believe Chris is still making me do it.